And this is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Boys. It is June 13th. This is your regular show, Here We Stand. And that was Sinead O'Connor and the folks singing Famine. Whether the genocide is over in my ancestors' land or whether it's here, it's the same murder and crime at the hands of the same bloody British Empire under whose authority this genocide continues and the cover-up today. Murderbydecree.com gives all the evidence, but it's more than facts, because it's become fashionable these days to talk about mass graves of children now, another fad. But the reality, the pain, the torture of what went on and what continues to go on is hidden. Well, we're on the show today to pull back the mask on that. And we begin by putting ourselves in the story. And that's why I played Famine to start off with, because my great-grandfather, Daniel O'Neill, left on a coffin ship in 1880 from the town of Cork, the port of Cork, that by the time the ship landed in Montreal, his entire family was dead from starvation and typhus. My great-grandfather Daniel suffered the same genocide. We put ourselves in that story by remembering Sinead O'Connor's words. She said, first you remember and then you grieve. Well, that's something we haven't done in this country. We've rushed past the remembrance and the grieving to get to a fake kind of healing. And that's why nothing changes, because the criminals are still in charge, but also the people, all of us who are complicit in this crime, don't want to grieve. We don't want to remember, really, because then we might change. The antidote to that is to not only put ourselves in the story, but hear from the eyewitnesses. And I'm honored today to have one of them with me. In a few minutes, you're going to hear from George Brown. Now, George is a Gitxsan native from northern BC originally. He was a retired Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer. And as a child, he was incarcerated in the United Church Edmonton Residential School. And don't forget, these are death camps, not schools, where half the children never came back. George was taken to the Edmonton School and then also incarcerated in the Charles Campbell Experimental Hospital in Edmonton. George went on to become not only an RCMP officer, but he actually served on their task force into residential schools. Once again, the criminal investigating himself, because the RCMP were, as far back as the 1930s, deputized to be the police arm of the residential schools. They would round up the kids, they would run them down, track them down along with the chiefs and the clergy whenever the children ran away from those death camps. So George is going to be on with us in a few minutes, and we're going to hear much from him. The other thing I wanted to mention to folks is that today is the 23rd anniversary of the launching of the first independent tribunal into crimes in residential schools in Canada. That happened June 12th to 14th, 1998. I helped organize that. The evidence came out back then, but even earlier, 2 years earlier, the Canadian government did this thing called Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, and in it they quote the 49% death rate. They even quote Indian Affairs Minister Duncan Campbell-Scott, who says 50% of the children who pass through these schools did not live to benefit from the education they had received. So this nonsense that people didn't know about the mass graves and the government pretending in a huge rewrite of history that they didn't know is a complete fallacy. The Royal Commission on Aboriginal People in 1996 quoted these facts. So we got to put that lie to rest, first of all. This is well known. They dug the graves. So naturally, they know they're there. They and the Catholic, Anglican, United Churches. It's a sign of the cover-up. And I wanted to share with you a few things that have come out just before George comes on. Some very important, really, revelations that came out from a number of insiders. And that's a good thing about this story hitting the media all over the world, is that people come forward more. It turns out that the mass grave in Kamloops, the news of that was leaked to the local media by dissident members of the Kamloops Band Council, because originally the plan was not to dig up those graves. And responsive to that leak, the Kamloops Band Council ran around and organized this dig, but behind closed doors. According to these sources, they're meeting presently with the RCMP and the BC Coroner's Office to contain the evidence on all of the fallout. And similarly, across the country, the government is concerned about the fallout from that. And so, according to this one source, by the end of June, well before Canada Day, they're going to announce other digs, especially at two sites, the Mission Catholic School east of Vancouver and the place that we dug at the invitation of the Grand River Mohawk Elders, the Mushhole, the Mohawk Indian School in Brantford, Ontario. you will be hearing in the news in the coming week or so that there are going to be other excavations, which are in effect destructions of a crime scene. It's the criminal going back and digging up his own crime scene when the government, their native lackeys, and the churches do these investigations. And there's more to say on that. The final point on, though, that you might have noticed, Prime Minister Trudeau announced that he's calling on the Catholic Church to release documents and take responsibility, which is absurd because he himself allowed the Catholic Church to destroy documents and not take responsibility. But in fact, what is pretty clear from sources of ours in Rome as well is that this call by Trudeau, who's, of course, a Jesuit-educated guy like his dad was, it's in fact a move by the church itself, because by being called on, you then have the initiative. And the Vatican is now moving to contain criticism, manage the information, and for a simple reason, because they're very concerned about the triggering effect this can have in other countries. Think of all of the mass graves all over the world of children and others put there by the Roman Catholic Church. Obviously, Rome doesn't want this spilling out from Canada. So all of that is very apropos to the discussion today. And, you know, we'll get into more of that. But a final point on the Sinead O'Connor song, you know, when a third of my people were slaughtered by absolute genocide in Ireland, they called it a famine to make it seem that deliberate genocide was an act of nature, just like they do here when they say the children died from TB, but that's some kind of natural occurrence. In fact, the kids were stuck together, sick and the healthy, and used. The germ warfare used against them in that way. So don't forget this pattern of killing a third. There was the Catholic Church had this saying in Europe all the time: kill a third, convert a third, deport a third. And that's exactly what they did to Ireland. And that was an even higher death rate in the Canadian Indian school death camps. So some food for thought with all of that. It's all at murderbydecree.com and has been for many years. And so without further ado, I'm going to bring on George Brown now, and we're going to talk about his knowledge and understanding of a lot of this and more. George, welcome to our show.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Now, I wondered if you could just tell the listeners a little bit about who you are, your background, maybe some of your childhood experiences, you know, before we get into the other stuff.
Yeah, my name is George Wallace Brown. I'm from Gitxsan Nation, St. Hazelton, British Columbia, northern BC, by Smithers and Highway 16. I spent 20 years in the military and 20 years with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and I was on the task force in 1994 with the Native North American Task Force investigating the abuses that occurred in the residential schools. And in 2002, I retired from the RCMP. Well, 2020 had cancer and chemo. So that's basically the Reader's Digest of my life. So,
right.
And also, I was a survivor of the residential school in 1949 to 52, the Edmonton Residential School, where we were shipped by train from Hazelton to Edmonton. And I spent 3 years there with my uncle and my cousin and numerous other children that were transported to these schools by train. So that's pretty well a Reader's Digest. Right. Besides that, I've been sober for 32 years. So there's a plus side to all this. So thanks for inviting me on your show.
Well, it's great to talk to you again, George. I know that we had actually met over 15 years ago and, you know, kind of exchanging notes about all this stuff. One thing I wanted to ask you, first of all, is if you're able to share some of your memory of what went on in that United Church facility in Edmonton and the Charles Campbell Hospital.
Yeah, when 1949 and to 52, they put us on a train, and then we ended up in Edmonton Residential School, and when we were stripped, we were de-liced, and they used DDT to put all over us, okay, to get rid of the lice, so they said. But during the course of the time, I was sexually abused, mentally abused, and physically abused, and spiritually abused. So we're brokenhearted and a broken spirit. And you can read between the lines what happens when you're sexually abused, physically and mentally abused. Another form of, you could say, mind control. So we're just guinea pigs at these schools, and we're always lack food and punished. And, you know, the girls were had a lot worse than us. They were quarantined on the other side of the fence and never left. They never left their area at all. So we don't know what really happened behind the closed walls. Only even after it was all said and done and we were finished with all that, nobody would talk about it. So a lot of horrific things that happened that a lot of our people will not talk about. So, the Campbell Hospital used to take us there by the busloads to the Campbell Hospital for I don't know what, but when I was between 5 and 8 years old, I can never remember being sick, but all I can remember is they put us out, okay? And when we woke up, they gave us an orange. I couldn't figure out why. What the heck did they do to us? So I have no idea. I still don't. So that's basically, in that school there, we, at the dorm, the schools were designed so there's no ventilation. And there's no ventilation, and your blankets are rubberized so the diseases could spread faster. And they just have one washroom that you could use for about 30 or 40 kids. And you're double bunked, right? They put the small kids on top of the bunk, and the older kids would kick the bottom, and you'd fly off into the air and land on the floor. And then between that, they called you in, it's your turn now to be sexually abused. So that's basically what went on. You can read between the lines what happened after that. So, so as a result of that, my mother went too. She went to Lee Jack up in Fraser Lake, and my uncles and my aunts. So you can imagine what the village was like without kids. So,
yeah,
it's a sad story and amazing. We got this far, really. A lot of us that fell through the cracks shouldn't have.
Well, no, I mean it's amazing that anybody survived these death camps. And one of the things you just said, I think, is really important as evidence in this criminal investigation, and that is. The schools were structured to spread disease, like no ventilation, no sanitary facilities, deliberately crashing your immune system so that a disease like TB would carry away a lot of kids, and then they could blame it on nature, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, and there's never any heat, too. You know, I can never remember any heat. So you're very clothed or very throwaway clothes that they, we didn't have enough to keep us warm. You know, I got to remember, too, these blankets they gave us were rubberized so they could spread the disease quicker, eh?
Do you remember the names of any of the people who did these things to you? Or have you included that? I don't know if you've done a court action or anything, but have these names been put out anywhere?
Well, what the task force did was they had a computerized system where I didn't have to, all I had to do was have to remember. For example, like a name like Mr. Jim, okay, and then somebody else that was abused by this individual would know the full name, and so when they punched Mr. Jim, all that information would come up. But this was the only time in history where you did not have to have the full name of the perpetrator that committed these crimes, because that's all they needed was a description. Or Mr. Jim, that type of information, and it will all come up, and then they were charged, and they were put away for whatever punishment they got in court. And that's
well,
how
actually, the very few people ever went to jail over this stuff, George, as you know. But one of the things that you remember that government and church established their own Truth and Reconciliation Commission into their own crimes. The mandate, if you look in section 2 of that mandate, it said the commissioners could not take down as evidence any reference to a dead child or to a capital crime. So it's structured as a whitewash from the very beginning, right?
Yeah, exactly. You see, what happened in the task force, Kevin, is the Crown Prosecutor in, say, British Columbia and the Attorney General in Ottawa both have to agree, say, if you want to charge the government. And we all know that's not going to happen. And that's right. How they operate today. And the task force was set up for criminal action, not for lawsuits. If they want, and if an individual wanted to go for a lawsuit, they had to go to a different avenue to go to court. We only handled criminal action. But
now that's what I want to talk a little bit, George. You know, when I started, after I got fired by the United Church in 95, first thing I did is I went to the Mounties and asked them if they were investigating this. And a guy called Jerry Peters, who was doing the task force, said that they didn't have a mandate. I got that backward. Paul Wilms was the first Mountie I spoke to, and he said they had no mandate to investigate deaths, which seemed a bit odd to me, being the Mounties. Jerry Peters contradicted him 6 months later and said they did have a mandate. So what was that all about?
See, what happened when the task force broke out, or in Port Alberni, I can't recall the person's name, the counselor over there, invited one of our plainclothes guys to come over to his office. He wanted to show some files to him, and then after he said, you let me know what you think. So the RCMP member went over, and he went into the office, and they dropped a whole bunch of files on the desk, and he wanted the RCMP member to review them. In his own words, he said, I only got down to a handful of files, and I started bawling my eyes out. And that's where the investigations began.
Right.
And that and the task force was put together to handle the abuses that occurred in the schools. Now, after all this was said and done, the task force, Ottawa, phoned the RCMP, and I got this from a pretty good source, and they wanted all the files of all the victims. And the RCMP said, no, you're not getting them.
So they said no to the government.
Yeah, they said no to the government, yeah.
Do you know why they
would? I was told that by a good source. So a lot of the stuff that we've done, it was, for example, you know, we had a workshop out here that in Chilliwack, in the Yaqui-Cusi Reserve, Frank Malloy's longhouse. We counted 55 victims in the car and in the at the seminary at the, and with not one person came forward. So that's how much trauma they went through. They don't want to cross that bridge again.
Well, also, George, you know, the chiefs themselves were telling their own people never to talk about dead kids. They struck a deal with the United Church, who was the first church that got sued, and that's why they got rid of me so quick. But they struck a deal. The head officers in the United Church said, we'll give you personal injury settlements, but only if you ignore the whole issue of dead children. And they did. So there was an arrangement at the top. And it sounds like it affected, like the question I had about the Mounties was, did they not release this stuff to the government because they knew it would get sat on? Or did they have their own motive in not releasing that evidence?
Well, the reason why they didn't release it, because they want all to destroy all the evidence. That's the bottom line.
Literally.
It's there's no other reason for it.
The Mounties
and they want to see what the survivors had to say, and they want to destroy all these records.
Did you have people actually imply that when you were in the Mounties that they needed to keep this stuff secret?
No. It's the members of the task force did an excellent job, and they followed up on all that they had to handle, but outside of that, we don't know what occurred.
Okay.
And seeing the task force, they didn't pick me to go on. I asked to go on, and they put me on.
Okay.
And so when I went to headquarters with the task force, and of course they had a big media, drew the media from all over, and the first person they came to was me, you know.
Okay.
Because I was native, and so in essence, I saved their bacon because they didn't have. If I wasn't there, they wouldn't have had no native policeman on there.
So, this is what I'm amazed at about Canada. You know, this happens all the time. They openly just, you know, bury evidence and talk like it had never existed, and then pretend that they're doing something about it, right?
Well, this is there's a lot that goes on that the public doesn't know about. Okay, they get a lot of charges going through the prosecutor's office. What happens after that is a mystery. The police right. do their job, and it gets. We always say deliver the garbage, and after that, it's up to them what they do with it. The Crown Prosecutor, that's the one that's got to answer the question.
Right. So, you know,
I've personally witnessed myself when I worked in Richmond, where the girl was sexually assaulted, and I stopped the bad guy, but the girl wasn't in there. But later on, she reported it to Vancouver City Police, and make a long story short, court date came up, and the girl didn't show up, so they threw it in the garbage because of who she was.
Well, I mean,
the drug addict. Now, you tell me, now, is that humanitarian? What is I supposed to do?
Yeah.
Where do you think I'd end up if I said something?
Well, in the river.
Exactly. So George, people better wake up and say, look, you better start looking into this and see what the heck's going on. If you don't, they're going to come after your kids. I can tell you that right now.
Yeah. Well, that's something that I wanted to ask you about, too, because I know that, you know, on Highway 16, there was another whitewash about the missing women. I mean, we've had reports of whole families going missing up there, and, you know, the whole thing gets buried. It's talked about in the international press, and yet nothing ever happens. It's like what's going on in Kamloops now with this mass grave. You know, everyone's talking about it, but no criminal charges laid. The perpetrators are running the investigation. I mean, you know, this is just so sickening. After a while, people just give up, right?
Well, that's another story, that highway of tears. And after retirement, I spent about an hour getting a blast from a person that experienced stuff on Highway of Tears, and I took it right on the chin, and she had no use for the RCMP. Because of what she had, they, like you just alluded to, there's no investigation done, you know.
Right.
There's suspects and there's good information not followed up on, you know.
You wanted to me to remind you of a guy called Vern Janelle?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, Vern, he was, he had 20 years in the military and joined the Mounties, and on his, graduation, he invited his whole family to Regina for the graduation, and the grandmother didn't go. And then when he came home and he asked his granny why he didn't show up, she told Vern, he said, I'll congratulate you on your career in the military and the RCMP. He said, but that uniform you're wearing took my kids.
Right.
So that's the reason why she didn't go. And that stigma still works, still happens in the reserves, by the way, the fear, right?
Yeah.
The fear, and that's very, like the prosecutor said in the task force, they went up to a northern part of BC there, and a fly-in that's only access they had by plane, and they got through talking to the village, and they were on the way back to the plane, and said the whole village was walking with him, and all of a sudden this plane flew over the top of them. And as it got closer, the whole village stopped walking. Only them kept walking. They couldn't figure out why they stopped walking. But as soon as the plane got closer, they see an RCMP crest. So that's how much fear it has on the people.
Right.
Because they think that they're coming there to pick somebody up to take them away again. See?
Right.
That stigma still sticks. And the same with people that wear shirt and ties. They're from a Department of Indian Departments, and they're seasoned kids, and that's the reason when they see a person with a certain tie on, they freeze.
Well, George, do you remember how they took you? Like, who took you down to the train when they shipped you up to the Edmonton school?
Well, you can remember about 5 in the morning, they just woke us up, the family woke us up, and you know something was going wrong, and you just know you're going to. You're going to be taken away.
Yeah.
Your heart's broken. You're screaming and hollering, and the train pulls out. Nobody there to help you.
No.
It's a horrible experience, just to experience that part.
Yeah.
People think it's fun when wait around long enough, China's going to take your kids.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. This is not a dress rehearsal. This is not a joke. This is real. And we have to face reality sometimes and expose these animals that were responsible for this.
They belong in jail.
I'm not talking for myself. I'm not talking for my anybody to save my bacon for money. I'm talking for the kids. The kids that are coming up now. The children, no matter if they're white, black, yellow, or red, they're coming after these kids. And if we don't stand in between the kids, they're going to take them.
Yeah.
If we don't wake up, this is what's going to happen.
Well, this is one of the ways people know if they... Yeah.
People think it's the damages that this created since the mid-1800s is awful. It's not even worth... that's the reason why a lot of our people don't cross that bridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people haven't even talked about suicides that happened on the reserves, you know. It's just like if nobody cares.
Yep.
All we are is a bunch of drunken Indians and lazy. We're no good for nothing. That's what they say. I'd like to see if people live with that for a while. See how they turn out after they sexually abuse you and beat you and break your heart. Then you can go out to make a living for yourself. How do you treat your loved one if you get married? You don't know how. You never taught the love. All they taught you is to be violent. And you use women like objects. That's how they taught us. Then they look at you as if you fell through the cracks, even our people turn against us.
Yep. Have you been shut out?
We've been shut out. I experienced it in my life, and I'm quite sure thousands of other people that left the reserve and made something for themselves, they basically not welcome. Especially you tell the truth.
Yeah.
The truth hurts, you know.
Yeah.
They don't want to face the truth.
George, can you tell us why you left the Mounties, 2002?
Well, I 2020 I had cancer, and the cancer was diagnosed back in 2013, the size of a soccer ball, ruptured, consumed 85% of my intestines, and from there I had chemo, but I didn't know I had cancer. I thought I was going crazy up in the head. Well, I am a little bit crazy up there, and I had the physical, and that's one of the reasons why I left. And then the last guy I arrested died in cells, so after that I just couldn't take anymore, and I just walked off the job.
Right.
And I didn't work just like anybody else. You know, I responded to calls. I've handled a lot of people that committed suicide, deaths on the highway. You know, it just goes pile on, doing next of kin, saying your son's not coming, you know?
Yeah.
Or your husband's not coming home. And it's just on and on. And all the police officers that were good police officers went through all this.
Right.
So,
George, you know, when I just had a question, you know, when we met, you were really, it was around at that time, just, I think right after you resigned. And I remember we met with some people in the downtown east side, and they were trying to get to the bottom of the disappearances there. And is there anything you learned about who was responsible, you know, for those people going missing all the time?
Well, I was the vice president of the board on the Native Liaison Society office, I listened to the women that were on the streets that cleaned up, and they talked about the Vancouver Club and the children. If you come off Highway Trans-Canada Highway and turn left on Hastings, and you'll come across a restaurant, Slow Can Restaurant, and then you cross a little overpass just on the Hastings, on the Trans-Canada side, another Pacific Coliseum side, is a transgender building. As soon as you get on the other side of the overpass, that's what they call the children's patrol. That's where they pick the kids up. Eh? Then the further east you go toward the Vancouver City Police, that's where all the low-end people are, the female, who are prostituting, eh, and alcohol and drugs.
Yep.
You see, the thing, too, is when they had the harm reduction site, when they did a survey, they went to a person that was struggling with drugs, and they give them $25, and they asked them, what do you think of the harm reduction site? Of course, you're going to say it's great. Mm-hmm. And one of the persons that were working at the society there, he said, George, didn't they pull up to an apartment building, I said, with these clean needles, he says, in the van. They're lined up around the block. Who lines up for empty needles?
Right.
So the big question was, what is in the needles? And a lot of these missing kids that were coming off reserve, these girls had mentioned, were being delivered to the Vancouver Club.
Right. Yes.
At that time, I was skeptical about the whole thing, but you fast forward to this time now, and it makes a lot of sense. These girls were speaking the truth.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's the bottom line. And the thing was, they closed that the society down, and that was the end. And I just moved on. And there's a lot more to that. A lot of these missing women stuff, organizations in Vancouver, I learned they called them poverty pimps. Poverty pimps were given so they can work. They didn't help the women one little bit.
Yeah. George, just to interrupt for a minute. You mentioned the Vancouver Club, and a lot of people have come forward, like Harriet Nahani, seeing kids taken from the Squamish Reserve on the North Shore by limousine to the back of the Vancouver Club. And when one of the people tried investigating that, they got beaten up and, you know, by the goons there. So, I mean, this stuff is so well known. It's even involved, you know, that lawyer, Jack Cram, who tried to bring this stuff out. He got thrown out, disbarred. Because he was naming judges, fairly senior Supreme Court judges in BC, doing that. He even had photographic evidence of them diddling young boys at the Vancouver Club. You know, now, I mean, this is so well known now. What do you think is going to take to bring this out, and who's going to do it, right?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. You look at what's going on today, and the quality of policemen they have is, I don't know how you're going to resolve this. It's just through the act of God. That's the only thing I can think of, and to expose these people, because if we don't stop them now, it's just going to get worse. That's the bottom line. And you take for the missing women, and you take the William Pickton farm. That's all probably tied in, you know.
Well. That's a whole third. I should mention at the part three in my book, murderbydecree.com, for people listening, we've got six different eyewitnesses describing everything George is talking about. And, you know, the thing about the whole Pickton thing, George, did you hear a lot about the other players in that? Because, of course, they picked Willie Pickton as the Lee Harvey Oswald there. But, you know, there were more we even had people see Dave Picton bring body bags out to the Musqueam Reserve near UBC. And, you know, they analyzed the remains, and sure enough, it was women and pig remains, but the media and the cops totally squelched that whole story. So there's a whole system at work here, like in the residential school, a whole system of cover up.
Exactly, they want to get rid of all the evidence, eh? So that's the bottom line. And there's people working on what you just discussed there, and they're doing their best they can to expose all this, eh?
You mean cops?
No, it's just other organizations, eh?
Right.
So they, they're out. They're doing their best to expose all this that's going on, because, they're trying to get rid of all these documents so there'd be no evidence to hold against the responsible party.
Right.
And that's the bottom line. If they don't have any evidence, then, how do you follow up on it?
Well, it's like if people ran their own tribunal and their own investigation, folks like you are invaluable to that, because you know the system and how it operates, right? And there's a lot of naivety out there among people, right, about the way the system works.
Well, of course, there's a lot of good people, police officers that have retired, that they're the old school type of guys, that these guys are excellent cops, you know. And for some unknown reason, they never made it to the top. Got promoted and getting these sensitive positions like plain clothes, so I cannot answer that, and I have my ideas, but that's all they are, is ideas. And and I bet you $100 and no donut that I'm bang on what I think can say. So it's what I experienced through life, and I've seen it unfold in the military and the RCMP, and I got lots of loyalty for both, military and RCMP, and they sobered me up, and I got nothing but good to say about sobriety and what they've done for me and the people that supported me through that. So it's not all dark and gloomy. So
you gotta, there's no climate for good people to come forward, because the corrupt ones seem to be running the show, right?
Well, you hit the nail on the head right there. See, what can the little guy do?
Well, did you ever know William George? Did you ever meet William Coombs, Billy Coombs?
Well, the Billy Coombs that
he was a survivor.
Yeah, he's a different Billy Coombs. I think that I dealt with out here. I met out here, and it's a different guy.
William Coombs survived. William saw those 10 kids taken from the Kamloops school, and then he died. Yeah. When he was about to go public about it, he got called to St. Paul's Hospital. The nurse said he had all the symptoms of arsenic poisoning, but the Claire Thompson, the BC coroner, said it was tubercular meningitis. Well, we wrote to her and asked her to explain the discrepancy there. It turns out she's the one going up to Kamloops to work with the band council on this dig. And if she issued a fake death certificate about William from Kamloops, just imagine what she could do up there to this. It seems like a organized cover-up again.
Well, it's they're all puppets, eh? It's the bottom line. It's just look at the paycheck, and that's who's behind it, eh?
Right.
You just follow the money, and that's who's behind all the stuff. And what can the little guy do, except do what we're doing now, is try to support one another so this doesn't happen again.
Right.
Because if we don't do this, then I'm telling you right now, these little guys running around here now won't have a hope in hell.
No.
And then we got to start thinking about the kids, eh?
Yep.
And the kids are the ones that are going to, they have no choice today. What choice do you have when you got to wear a mask and you can't do this, you can't do that? What else are you going to do to these guys?
Well, it sounds like residential school. Frankly, exactly. It sounds like, same process.
Well, the mask is the star of David for us, eh?
Right.
And that's, God help us if we don't help the kids, you know. Who's going to stand up for them?
In the Indian Act, George, mandatory vaccinations have been the law on Indians reserves since 1874, right? You know, Elder at Stolo Nation told me that, the Health Canada came in the other day and started shoving needles on our baby's arms. We couldn't do anything about it or we'd go to jail. Yeah. I mean, now it's happening to everybody, right?
Well, that's communism, you know. I mean, communism has been here for a long time because, what do you call reserves? We've been dependent on the government since day one. Isn't that communism?
Well, it's creating that dependent thinking, you know, and you find that a lot with survivors. I mean, you know, that they just don't dare to think that they can do anything about their situation, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And certain individuals do fall through the cracks, and that's the people we should be promoting, the people that fell through the cracks and succeeded. And there's a lot of Native people across the country that have succeeded in life, but you never read or hear about them.
Right.
You know, and these are the ones that could help the community, not just the reserves, but all communities. You know,
right.
I mean, I joined the Army. Before I joined the Army, I asked the school teacher who fought in the Korean War. He was a Native. And I said, what are my chances in a white man's world? He said, you got to work twice as hard to be equal.
Yeah.
And I kept that right to the day I'm sitting right here. You know. It's that's just a fact, you know. And,
No, you're pretty unique, George. I mean, there are very, very few survivors of this torture that ever are able to speak about it and come forward and take a stand like you have. I just want to honor you for that reason. And I had another question about, and I, you know, if it's hard to answer, don't worry. But when you were in Charles Council Hospital. One of my friends, Doug Wilson, was there right at the same time, and he's from Haida Gwaii. And he said he went into Council Hospital, same thing that you described, but when he woke up, he couldn't remember how to say his mother's name in his own language. And he said, how do you ever forget your mother's name? But he couldn't remember it anymore, like his memory being swabbed. Do you think, I mean, does that sound realistic about what might have been going on there?
Of course it's realistic, because look what they did to us, like a school bus load of kids. Each one of us were put out, you know, were put under.
Yeah.
And when you woke up, you didn't know what the heck happened.
Right.
Number one, I dare anybody to go look in our in the history books and see how to get our report cards from these schools. Right? They're supposed to teach us something? Well, produce them. Produce the school report cards. I'll bet you $10 a donut you won't find one.
Nope. It wasn't schooling.
Well, no schooling. I asked my uncle about that, and he said, you know, all he said was dark and dungy. That's all he remembers. He said, and what happened to him? Was he electrocuted too? You know?
George, you know, I found a report on Charles Council Hospital that said in a 3-year period, in the late 50s, they received over $12 million in funding from military for research. And, you know, that was going on all over the place at that time. But, you know, this CIA mind control experimentation, I'm sure that, you know, we know that they drew on you kids all the time as guinea pigs for that.
Well, there's got to be some truth to that, okay? Like, look at how we turned out. We're the guinea pigs.
Yep.
Just look around the reserves. It's all there.
Yep.
Now the whole world has become a reserve, you know?
Right.
You go figure when my mom said, they used to go to church up in Hazleton, you know, and then you go to church. He said they had a rope right down the middle of the church. The white man on one side and the Indians on the other side.
Right.
So you tell me what's wrong with that picture. Yeah. How come the Indians have to go around the back the building to go to the doctor and often the white man goes through the front?
Yep. Yeah, the BC ferries segregated that way too. The Indians had to ride down on the where the cars were.
Well, I talked to the elder over there in Sydney there in Indigenous Games they had, and he said, you know, George, he said, I worked as a mechanic at the garage. He said, the immigrant come over, he couldn't fix nothing. He said, so they put him sweeping floors. He said, and I'm the mechanic, and he made more money than me. Right. So there's just one little example, you know.
George, we got less than 5 minutes. I definitely want you to come back on and talk about anything you want, but is there anything kind of final message you want to leave to the listeners today?
The final message is wake up. Can you hear that train coming? They're coming for your children. That's the message. Wake up.
Yeah.
All of us.
Yeah.
We got to stand in between the children and these evil people. Because if we don't do that, the children won't have a future. They won't have a free choice to choose what they want to be. And they'll take all that away, and then we will have nothing. And there's a higher court than this that we have to stand before the Lord to tell the Lord he's going to judge us for this. And the people that stand by, there's a special place in hell for you for not standing up for the kids.
Right.
That's the final message, and that's what the Lord has in my heart to tell. It's not me. It's not. I'm just here to glorify the Lord's name, not my name or anybody else's name.
Thank you, brother. Your words mean a lot. They're,
yeah. And, well, thanks for inviting me on the show, and that's reality, and I hope we all face it, and wisdom will take us through it.
Thank you, George.
Okay,
we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye for now.
Yeah, bye-bye.
That was George Brown, former Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer on the West Coast, member of their residential school task force, and, of course, a survivor of the Edmonton death camp and the Charles Council Hospital. Just in closing, for people who want to act, who are willing to go beyond knowledge, there is a Canadian Genocide Tribunal being set up independently of the government. According to international law, the government, its native employees, and the churches are not allowed to investigate their own crime or publish a narrative about it. They have to get away from these crime scenes because they're destroying evidence, they're obstructing justice. An alternative is being built, Canadian Genocide Tribunal. It involves people who are already in Canada, as observers. They're at the Kamloops site. They're documenting the obstruction of justice going on there. There'll be more on that in the future, including more insiders and people in the police who have helped us get to the heart of what's really going on. If you want to be part of that, first of all, educate yourself, murderbydecree.com. All of our links, all the evidence, the former ITCCS site, ITCCS.org, the tribunal said, was taken down, but a lot of the evidence from there is up at murderbydecree.com under ITCCS archives. You can write to the tribunal, ITCCS office at protonmail.com, and tune into the show every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific. But in closing, we are going to be concentrating a lot on the fact that this coroner, Claire Thompson, who deliberately lied about the cause of William Coombs's death. In writing, we have a copy of the death certificate here, which contradicts all of the medical evidence and the testimony of the last nurse who treated William, Chloe Kirker, who said he had the symptoms of arsenic poisoning. The same Claire Thompson who issued this fake death certificate is now up in Kamloops and heard the BC Coroner's Office, which you're going to hear in the media, being applauded for helping the Van Council. No, they're helping to obstruct justice. The BC Coroner's Office specializes in the destruction of evidence about the deaths of Native people, including way back into the history of the Indian schools, so-called residential schools. So this is a kind of obstruction of justice we have to monitor and stop. Write to us, ITCCS office at protonmail.com, to be involved in that. Most importantly, folks, we need you to write to us. You can write to me personally, Kevin Ann at angelfire101@protonmail.com. We have flyers. We should start picketing and occupying and seizing the properties of the Catholic and the Anglican and the United Churches. They are convicted criminal bodies. They've lost their right to govern, as has the Canadian government and the criminally convicted monarch who claims ownership of this whole country. Well, we create the alternative today and in everything we do, and this tribunal is one step towards that. So please get involved. The last song we're going to hear is again from Ireland. It's called The Wind That Shakes the Barley. And the barley seeds blowing in the wind was a metaphor for the Irish Republican Army, the resistance movement there that defeated the Crown forces and established a republic. It's that even though individuals may fall and be killed, the seed is scattered in the wind and will plant many seeds out of which will grow a new nation. So that's a message for today. There is an answer to this madness, and it's only what we create, a new sovereign Republic of Canada in which these crimes of genocide can be erased forever and the guilty institutions that are still in power can be put on trial and disestablished. That is our answer to the children on the ground. And like George Brown says, the children who will die tomorrow if we don't take action. So here's the song. Come back next week. Stay strong. Stay clear. This is Kevin Annett, Eco Strong Voice, the great grandson of Daniel O'Neill. I thank you.